welcome everybody to iloverealestate.tv. Great to have you back. And this week I have an amazing speaker to share his knowledge with you. I'm at the I Love Real Estate Super Conference and we've all had a fabulous time. And I've managed to second this gentleman to come off and out to the side so we can really get some insight into where Australia's going. Now, the person I'm going to introduce you to now is somebody that I have followed for years. He's somebody I respect highly. He is a leader in his field. In fact, I would say that this next gentleman you're going to be hearing from is someone who is the best economist in Australia. Now, that's my recommendation, so I'm going to introduce him now and you make up your own mind. The person, of course, that I'm talking about is Mr. Jason Anderson. Hey, Jason, how are you?
Hey, Dipna, I'm very well, thank you.
Very good. Now, you've had a huge background. I mean, you're the guy that everybody goes to when they want to know where to start investing. I mean, you work for some of the hugest, biggest boys in Australia. And they take your advice, not only in Australia, internationally as too, as to where they're going to be investing. And they take your advice and throw literally hundreds of millions of dollars at projects, basically on your say-so. Is that right?
That's certainly the case. And the good thing about the work I do and the opportunities I have is that, you know, our clients are very factually based. So they will track what you say and they will work with you for as long as you can get things right. But if you get things wrong, they can be unforgiving.
Well, I guess just the fact that how long you've been around in the industry is pretty much testament to the fact that you get it right most of the time.
Well, we aim to focus on turning points in the market and where we think things are not being interpreted correctly or where there's misinformation, because by definition that's going to be the areas where there's value potential. And so for a lot of bigger investors, they don't want to hear the same old story or the same old interpretation. They're actually looking for some provocative thinking and looking for changes in trends.
So they're looking for the next place to go and spend a few hundred million dollars.
Absolutely. Most of the biggest entities, property trusts, developers, they're all very funding constrained. It's rare for them to be able to take a position in one market without trying to work out where to remove themselves from in another. So it's very much a rotation exercise from the big guys' point of view. And what that means is not only do they have to get the point of entry right, they also have to get a point of exit right.
Yeah.
So it's a tougher exercise now than what it was prior to the global financial crisis.
Okay. Now, you work with MacroPlan?
Yes, my employer is MacroPlan Damasi, and I'm a senior economist there, and I've been there for getting on to 2 years now.
Wow, has it been that long?
Yeah, it's been a fantastic experience. We've got expertise in terms of planning, so we look at projects from the very start, before they've even got really development approval, as well as looking at projects that are at the marketing stage or looking at defining it in terms of what the building format is going to be. So we're really an A to Z. We do a lot of bottom-up work, but my passion is also for looking at the wider environment and the macro conditions.
Okay. I mean, I remember following you and quite a lot of years earlier than that when you were the head economist with BIS Shrapnel. And, you know, you made the move across to MacroPlan, and, you know, your career and your predictions and everything else have just gone in leaps and bounds since then from what I've seen.
Okay, we're at a point where the environment in the last 2 years for most developers has been very tough at a national level, but there's certainly areas of opportunity, but there's also areas to be wary of. So it's an environment where there is an advantage in having a macro view of things, and that's what the media will focus on. They'll focus on where are interest rates at, where's China going to, what's going to happen in Europe. And some of those things are important, and it's good to be educated on. But my experience is that really it's now very much project-specific analysis, and it's a matter of getting the format right, getting the timing right. So to do that, you need a bottom-up piece of work, and that's what the developers are increasingly wanting. They want to have a view on, okay, they've got land in a bank in a whole lot of different cities, but how should they set up, and what's the timing, and when's the best point of entry?
Timing's huge. And, you know, I guess I've had you along talking to my listeners and, you know, my students and things over a number of years now. Mm. And I know you've been very influential in you know, your areas and where you've targeted and things like that in helping those much smaller investors than the guys you're normally consulting to make some really good dollars. I mean, I was talking to one of my students last weekend, and he was saying that on your advice, well, you were just talking at one of my seminars, and on your advice you were talking about, you know, certain things happening in Melbourne and that sort of thing, and he took that advice and he actually sold and got into the marketing plan a good 6 months to 8 months earlier than he had planned to. He sold off the plan. He absolutely picked the top of the market. Has done really, really well on that project, and he's gone off and then invested in positive cash flow properties elsewhere as a result of that. Now, had that not happened, and had you not come along to that particular seminar at that time and had a talk, and had he not been in the audience and been one of my students and all of that kind of stuff, realistically, had he sold when he had planned to sell some 8 months later, it would have been in a much different market, a much declining market. And we did some figures the other day and we looked at comparable sales then. He would have lost about $100,000. Well, he would have made $100,000 less had that happened. So it's pretty big stars on your shoulders that, you're able to help so many people.
Well, I think, again, coming back to the view that it's very project specific, that means that the viewpoints and the advice are just as powerful for someone who's got one smallish project as what they are.
Duplex.
Yeah, so it's just as important for people at that end to get a full spectrum of view, to get the macro view as well as get the sequencing of the decisions right. And by that I mean, obviously, my views in terms of timing, but also in terms of getting the planning process aligned with the cycle, and that is a challenging feature just as much as for the big players, for the big property trusts. If anything, it's probably harder for them because by the time they've made a commitment, they're in for the long haul. So it's all about getting that granularity of view, and I'm very passionate about that because there are points in time where it's sufficient to just have a bottom-up or project-specific view. There are other times where you have, I think, a clarity of vision as to what the macro environment is going to do and when it's going to change. And if you have that, then you've got a very powerful tool for talking to anyone, because what you have is a point of strategy for people. And it's a matter of then taking that point of strategy and trying to align it with your financing decisions and your overall status in terms of a project that you might have. And if you can bring that together, there are opportunities in this market. So it's not a matter of taking the macro media view, which is residential property is in tough times, has been for a couple of years, this is the life as we know it. The reality is that there are plenty of opportunities. They're much smaller and much more fragmented than what they've been in the past. And that's actually an advantage for your smaller investor because they don't need to take a big position. They can afford to cherry pick. They can afford to wait for distressed assets. They can afford to be very selective in geography as to where they go.
Mm, okay. Look, you hear all this stuff out in the media and, we all know that the media is there to sell advertising or to sell newspapers or whatever else. And, you know, they have a role and that's great. But you hear a huge amount of varying opinions. Let's deal with some of those. I mean, at the moment, you know, you mentioned them briefly before. We've got talk about China. We've got talk about what's going on in Europe. And we've got talk about America. And, you know, how does that really affect us in Australia? I think a lot of people get very confused about the mixed messages that are coming out there. And I think also that they get swamped in the magnitude of things, and they forget to think about what's really core and what's important. And, you know, what we're talking about here is the residential housing market and then how that flows onto real estate market. We're not talking about, you know, shoes. We're not talking about education, we're talking about all those other things. We're talking about housing. So how does it affect our housing market? Let's deal with each one of those individually. And let's start with, we'll say Europe. How is that going to affect us here in Australia as real estate investors?
Well, the primary way that there will be some impact is through the financial markets. So not through global economic growth, which is already pretty weak and is likely to remain so. The greatest effect will be through the cost of funds. And we know that the Australian banks are probably the leading corporates globally, not just within the financial sector, but amongst any companies. So they're extremely well managed. And what they've done is they've tactically chosen to prepare for higher funding costs. Those higher funding costs are coming through because of the financial conditions in Europe, the inability of governments to raise funds without having to pay a much higher premium. So the global cost of debt has gone up, and our banks have actually absorbed already a fair degree of that rising cost, and there is scope for them to continue to do so. So the bottom line is it's really coming through the financial markets, not an area that's well understood by most commentators, and so it tends to get sort of bundled up in a whole issue of
fear and emotion mainly.
Well, absolutely, and to a degree that's warranted because there is a fundamental uncertainty as to how things will pan out. I don't think that you'll get much clarity on that, and it will take many, many years for the way forward to become clear. So to a degree, I would say set it aside as an issue. Probably the best benchmark for understanding how the markets are considering this area is to look at the Australian dollar. Because in the past, for example, during the GFC, when there was a huge amount of angst about financial market conditions, the Australian dollar absolutely tanked. What the difference this time around is the Australian dollar is proving to be extremely resilient. And this is not just about we have a good economy. This is about, well, actually, what's going on in Europe, you know, is uncertain for sure, but it probably isn't going to have deep or short-term impacts on the Australian economy. Because if that was the case, then, and if markets were following through on that, then the Australian dollar would have already fallen below 80 cents US.
Mm. Okay. So, I mean, you talk about the banks there, and obviously we're highly regulated, and it's been the thing that has saved us through the GFC, really, with our regulation and banking system, because you look to America where the banking system is totally up the creek. And I know for myself, being over there as an investor, you know, you could get 110% loans. They were non-recourse loans, that they didn't even chase you if you didn't pay. You know, they were stated income. So basically, in filling out the form whether you wanted the loan, you'd make up a figure. In fact, you were encouraged to make up a figure so it would go through. And there was no recourse on that at all. And so whatever figure you put in the box, that's what we'll believe. Well, there was no checking, there was no balancing at all. So it was kind of a banking system that had to fail. So let's talk about America then, because obviously it's on its knees. Its property market's a huge opportunity for Australians to go over there and start investing in some of the better properties and things over there, which have got great strong yield. How is that going to impact us from a residential perspective here?
Well, I think, again, it's more through the cost of funding. Now, the positive news, particularly in the last few weeks, is that there seems to be some traction coming through in terms of both monetary policy and fiscal policy in the US housing market. There seems to be some evidence of improvement in demand for new housing. There seems to be some areas where there is actually tightness and shortages coming through again. And as a result, prices have stopped falling. So what would be, and has been hoped for the US for some time, is that the oversupply of housing, which came through because of all of those extremely loose lending policies that you mentioned, that what will happen is that the actual residential building cycle will start to recover in the US. It may only be a tepid, gradual recovery, but one of recovery. And what that will mean is that the US economy, rather than going into recession, can record fairly moderate, tepid economic growth. And if we got that outcome, what we would have then is a much greater capacity for the Europe's problems to be manageable, because at least there is a store of value still in global currencies, which is through US dollars and US denominated government bonds. That they are not as devalued as Europe. That's maybe as good as you can put it. But I think that environment is a key factor in why the Australian dollar has stayed strong, because we still have this very huge unevenness in global growth, where we have China and Asia kicking on and Europe now heading back into recession. But the US, if it can stay on the positive side of growth, means that we, you know, there is a way forward, which is not one of capitulation in terms of government debt markets, because if we have that outcome, then we will get a much bigger increase in the cost of funds, and it will be hard for Australian banks to absorb that. So again, it's treading a fine path, but one we're still moving along, and it is happening gradually. And the fact that it's happening gradually is probably the most important thing, because what we don't want is a shock that then pushes up the global cost of funds very quickly, and Australian banks start to pass that on as higher interest rates.
Mm. Because, you know, all the talk at the moment seems to be that the Reserve Bank will lower interest rates throughout the year, and we're going to be able to benefit from that. And, you know, as you said, the recovery in America is definitely happening. I mean, you know, I was recommending certain areas in America 2 years ago to students of mine, and now I'm not recommending those areas because I've already outgrown the yield ratios that we look for in the States. So, you know, they've already experienced growth. And I know some areas, they're going gangbusters, and, you know, there's a million people a year going into one particular city in America. Like, that's the size of Brisbane, a city growing by the size of Brisbane every year. And so it's not all gloom and doom like people think. There's certainly pockets of the markets and things like that are absolutely on their knees, and that's where the opportunities are. But it's not everywhere, and you really are starting to see the building industry starting to start. We're starting to see more applications for building and that kind of stuff, which is all good signs for the States. So, you know, what you outlined there is probably something that gives us a little bit of comfort from an Australian perspective and what it means for our markets here. So let's talk about the elephant in the room, being the one that everybody seems to throw out there as to what's happening in China, and, you know, they're not growing the way they were and all that sort of stuff. I think one... Just be, you know, as a side on that, people seem to forget our other major markets like India and the like that are backing up there behind. But let's talk China first. What's your view on that?
Well, I think, again, one of the great ironies of the last 50 years is that we have a communist government that's proving to be much more effective predictors and managers of financial market conditions than perhaps...
Democracies.
That, to a degree, may not be that unusual, because I think what we've got in China is clearly a central bank that is very sharp, but is also aware of the fact that the local banking system, which is very much local government owned and run, does have the prospect of running off the rails in a, you know, maybe some comparable fashion to what happened in the US. And so they're very active in terms of pulling back on lending ratios and pulling back on credit creation. And that's where they've been for most of the last 12 months. They've actively sought to cool the growth in China.
Yeah.
And in particular, they've been focused on, the rate of residential construction. That's come back somewhat. That's what's caught attention in Australia because it's not this ever exponential rate of activity. No, it's not. It's going to level out, but at such a rate that we're going to need to still be increasing our iron ore and coal exports. But if they see signs of prices coming off, actual declines in some cities, that they're prepared to respond to that. And so we've had rate cuts and we've had some improvement in credit growth again. So they're very conscious of trying to run this middle line between, not too hot and not too cold. Exactly, yeah. Right. And it's proving to be very canny. And look, beneath the surface, there is lack of visibility in terms of the lending process, in terms of local government and so forth. But when we look at how the central bank is managing things, we should take great comfort. And while that means that the growth phase is not uniformly one of 9% growth every single year, for Australia, it's one of this longer term prospect. And moreover, it's one where China, for us, historically we've seen it as just being iron ore and coal and therefore highly cyclical. We're moving into a phase where, no, it's much more around China's energy needs, and that this is about LNG and coal seam gas. And this is where the major projects are happening in Australia. They are unrelated to the rate of growth in China or in Japan or in Korea, because we're getting contracts, from all of these countries. It's about the need to substitute away from oil and away from coal-fired electricity. And that's a technical change in the economy. This isn't about growth. This is about a shift in format, and one that is playing out to the huge benefit of the Australian economy.
I think it's something that people tend to forget is, we hear all the figures how China's, consolidating and things like that. It's actually a good thing for Australia, in my opinion, because what it means is that we can actually keep up the capacity to be able to supply their need. Whereas at one stage there was looking like a runaway train. I thought, my God, where are we going to get our production up to be able to handle it? But in real dollars, in real terms, what it means is that they need every scrap of our capacity right now going out the door, and it will be increasing over the ensuing years, not decreasing.
That's right. We have the biggest problem for Australia in a global context is not the rate of economic growth globally. It's the fact that we can't actually, a cost-effective way, do all the projects that we would want to do. So we have cost blowouts which have delayed projects. There are certain projects which won't be delayed as a result of cost increases, but there are others that will, and others that will become uneconomic. And what it's doing is obviously pushing the attention back on the Australian labour market. There's been a lot of focus on using overseas workers, even just on a temporary basis. But the reality is that for a lot of these projects, the pay scales that are available should be attracting people left, right and centre in Australia, but it just doesn't seem to happen at a macro level. And as a result, we are having to get more workers from overseas. But to a degree, I think we've got to see this as part of the openness of the Australian economy, that we benefit from having this trading power. That's great. But it shouldn't all just be one way. That, yes, we want Australian workers and we want Australian employment, but we're part of a global economy, and we've got to use those overseas skills to the fullest capacity, because that's how we achieve a better cost structure. So there is challenges there in terms of the management process.
Very fine line you walk there.
It is, and clearly, there's laments about the need for local training and local education. My view is that some of those are overdone, because I know, having with my partner working in the industrial relations field that there are a whole lot of training courses for unemployed people where they just don't even turn up, let alone, you know, try and take advantage of that. So I don't think it's a matter of looking at the level of unemployment. I think it's more a matter of saying, well, we actually, in order to get Australians away from Sydney, Melbourne, you know, the bigger cities, we have to pay a huge premium, and to be honest, the projects may not be able to cope with that. So what do? We either don't do the work or we get in workers from overseas.
Mm. I mean, we've got a very low unemployment rate and things, and that would be exacerbating the situation. Let's go back to on the global scale, then we'll go a little bit more micro level. India, you know, it's backing up strongly and behind China and a major trading partner of ours.
Yes, and it to a degree is more hidden in some respects. The degree of openness or transparency in terms of business is probably, if anything, less in India than what it is in China. That there's a lot of incumbent interests, and the private sector is much more active in terms of steel manufacturing and electricity generation, and so that makes it a more difficult market to read sometimes, whereas the pace of growth in particularly in China's capital cities has been so unrelenting that really we've found it a lot easier to get traction. So I think the aspects for India, again, it comes back to energy generation, because this is a country with, in proportional terms, a lot greater poverty than what is evident in China. And once those poverty issues start to get addressed, and that may well take some time, that the energy utilisation capacity of India will absolutely propel demand for petroleum to the point where, you know, we will be reaching the limits much more quickly. And it will become evident that we need to switch into alternative fuels. So I think, again, for Australia, it's about that LNG generation. Certainly there's aspects in both countries where there's a desire to help invest in Australian commodity projects. And, in fact, that's already happening. Look, we go back to Japan in the early 90s, the late 80s, and that was happening in spades back then. It continues to be a major source of funding for us. So I think the third element in terms of India is probably the food and the commodity as commodities, and that's a key source of exports for Australia. You know, it's an area which has been bit sort of subdued the last few years because we've had drought and so forth, but we're now moving into a much better physiological environment for those products, and they are critical to actually enabling some of those poverty-stricken areas to kick out, because food pricing is a big issue for those countries, and it is a threat to their local economic growth.
Mm. Well, and I've always been on the bandwagon of protect our food belts of all descriptions right around Australia, and, you know, keep the land ownership here in Australia. And decentralisation is something else that, you know, I've been very, very strong on for some time, and it's something that this last phase, so the last 4 or 5 years, has really started to see a lot more decentralisation, and I think it's a good thing for Australia as a whole. Let's talk on a micro level here in Australia, and we'll go around the major capital cities. Let's talk about where you see the greatest growth potential, if we're talking major capital cities in Australia.
Well, I think from a population point of view, and thereby into the local economy and thereby into the residential property market, it's clearly Perth by a long stretch. A market where pricing is now back to where it was 5 years ago, and yet with the incredibly low unemployment rate and is set for ignition again in terms of the rate of construction, it's already starting to pick up. So I think Perth overall, in growth rate terms, has got the biggest upside. Following closely behind that, not so much from a magnitude point of view, but more from a timing point of view, is Brisbane. And we know that the Brisbane market is tightening very quickly. Brisbane's population growth has really slowed very, very sharply, much more than any other city in terms of the slowdown in population growth. But the flip side to that is, I think it's, and this is not unusual for Brisbane, it does tend to, even more than Perth, fluctuate very substantially over the cycle, is that it's now set for a clear rebound in population growth. Both of those cities have what I would call fairly green CBD markets. They're underrepresented in terms of professional services, in terms of consulting services, contractor services, legal, accounting, so on and so forth. The epicentres for those have always been Sydney and Melbourne. And we got close to the point where Brisbane was just starting to become much bigger player in that score, but then we've had the GFC and so forth. But I think both Brisbane and Perth have the greatest transformation in terms of their CBD and expanding that white-collar workforce. So that will be the next... The difference in the next leg of growth there is what you'd call a labour market deepening, that it's not just about people coming in and doing blue collar work, which was the traditional cycle for Brisbane and Queensland, for Brisbane and Perth, and thereby for regional areas in both states. That now it's going to be a white collar contribution, and that changes the dynamics of the property market, because you're going to get a lot more support for inner city living. You're going to get a lot more support for people looking at new housing. And making a commitment to being in those cities for the long term.
So the major markets there, we're talking inner city, we're talking the regentrification, if you like, of that immediate rim around the city, so all the places knocked down, build four, build two, build three, whatever you fit on the site, maximise the site. And then there's opportunities, I guess, for the flow-on effect from that, which is then the families, which flows out. So it's kind of like a pebble in the pond effect, really, where if you kind of drop it in the centre of the city, it dribbles out from there, yeah?
Yes. I mean, both cities, in terms of the fringe, if you went back to the last cycle, entered that cycle with really very affordable subdivision lots.
Agreed.
They don't have that advantage this time. Mm-hmm. Look, I think there's definitely been improvement in the relative affordability in terms of lots, as we've had some unwinding of the premiums that were paid for vacant land back in 06, 07, 08, depending on Brisbane or Perth. But the situation is one now where I think we're going to see smaller lots. We're going to see people focused on affordable product, and if the planning system allows it, hopefully it will, then that can be the roots of the fringe areas growing again. But look, in relative terms, it's not as compelling a value proposition, and it will be a more gradual but still an extended path. What that means in terms of the supply is that it's going to take longer for supply to catch up with the population growth than it did last time, where in both cities it kept up quite nicely. This time I think it's a bit like Western Sydney, where it's the affordability of land was very challenging, and so you've had a five, almost 10-year phase of extreme tightness in the rental market. I think we're going to get that tightness in both of those cities extended for a long period of time, and that provides the underpinning for price growth. It also provides the basis for more infill projects within middle ring areas, which is what we've seen in Sydney.
That's right. So let's go to Sydney now. What's the go in Sydney?
Sydney is finally, for the first time probably since the 1990s, entering a fairly standard, plain vanilla economic cycle. We're starting to see some recovery in terms of residential building, more so, more clearly in terms of house and land in the fringe. Still very patchy in terms of infill projects, but the ones that have got away with the off-the-plan concession have done very well, whereas it's the middle, small-scale developers are finding it very hard. And so, I think overall it's an economy where we're seeing some initial improvement, and then we've got a big project now looking like it will actually get through in the next couple of years and underway, which is Barangaroo. And we need some of these big iconic projects. M5 widening would be another one that we haven't had, you know, for a very long time. And I think with that, those kinds of projects, as well as the relative affordability of land in the outer ring suburbs, these are the seeds for a fairly ordinary, not a really rapid recovery, but one that has good
controlled growth,
and one that has good roots to it, standard roots to it. And we know that the state government has now shifted its focus towards incentivising new dwellings for first home buyers. I think in some areas of Western Sydney that will be a real benefit, because that's where there is a lot of pent-up demand. It's where we've seen rental growth be very strong. I think we will get transmission from that. I am concerned about the lack of support for infill projects. I think it's still going to be a struggle for them, particularly now the off-the-plan concession is gone. There are some big iconic projects which will do well. We've got Central Park in Chippendale, we've got Harold Park, and obviously we've got Barangaroo Residential. But the middle ring is still struggling, and there are still, unfortunately, overly onerous planning constraints on these projects in Sydney, and it's probably the number one hindrance to that recovery.
Okay, so let's talk briefly, say, Darwin and Hobart.
Well, Darwin is positioned extremely well. I think it's had fits and starts over the last 5 years. Where it's had starts, it's gone really well, and then the market's died off somewhat. And I think what we're seeing now is, again, some foundation projects. Obviously, the Impex project is one that grabs a lot of attention, but the actual act of constructing the work camp to support those workers is a big project. That we're seeing US forces being having housing bases in Darwin. We're seeing some initial signs that there'll be commercial projects in the CBD getting underway. So there's actually more now that's rather than being on the horizon, that's actually concrete coming through in the next 2 years. I think the population growth will then, particularly in terms of overseas migration, is set to move to a quantum leap. You know, and it could be doubling of that migration inflow in the space of 2 years, and then, you know, it has been a tight rental market for a long time, but that we then start to get some clearer transmission in terms of demand for new housing. And there are quite a few subdivisions. There's a better range of supply at the moment. There's a greater competition amongst developers, and as we've seen in Canberra, that when you have that environment, you can actually, you know, in a small city, enjoy a very rapid upturn in terms of sales. So I think Darwin is heading down that path. Again, a city that needs some maturing in terms of its CBD, in terms of that office workforce and white collar. And once that happens, then the whole dynamic and the depth of demand in terms of the property market starts to mature.
Okay, Hobart?
Hobart is a tricky beast. I think that, unfortunately, it's lost momentum in terms of, movement out from Melbourne to Hobart in the last couple of years. That, as a result, the residential building cycle is weakened. And what that's meant is that even though it's really still very affordable, that The local economy there is actually in quite difficult conditions. It's had a manufacturing and an export-oriented set of industries which are now really heavily challenged, very, very tough environment. If you're looking at timber or, you know, even in terms of food product exports. So I think it's not for the faint-hearted. And I think it's much more of a market for locals, because you need to look at what the local market, you know, is prepared to pay. There is some, you know, prospect of a biggish waterfront development there in Hobart. I think that's, to be honest, still a few years away. So, yeah, look, there's a lack of momentum there. It's looking somewhat like Adelaide, where it's a city that actually tracked in terms of affordability, and was able to attract pretty good inward migration for quite a few years up until about 2 years ago, and then the appetite seems to have faded, and with that the residential cycle in terms of construction has waned, and it's entered a bit of a tailspin.
Okay, so continue with Adelaide. We're looking at Hobart being relatively flat. Mm. Darwin's got some upside. Mm. Adelaide, relatively flat. However, you know, saying all of those things, that doesn't mean that you can't make money in those cities, but you're going to have to do manufactured growth, you know, much smaller scale deals than you would be talking about to the big boys. But, you know, from our retail end of the market, there's still money to be made, but it's going to be, you're not relying on growth to give it to you, you're relying on what you do to the property to give it to you.
Yes, and, you know, again, probably the best place to look is to draw parallels out of Sydney, which went through such a long, extended residential downturn. But there was still, middle ring infill projects that were performing reasonably well, more aligned to probably the upper half of the market, not so much the bottom half of the market. And that I think is the way forward. It's not so much in terms of fringe areas. I think some of that demand is going to stay weak for a fair while, but particularly in an environment, and this is true of all the cities, where you've got retirees becoming much more of a focus, is to look for smaller scale, probably even duplex structure developments within established areas, more with a skew to the higher income areas, and try and pitch that to some combination of retirees and indeed even to rental properties for the, you know, because there is still a need. We're not evidence in any of those cities of the rental market being particularly a problem. So I think again in those areas start thinking about the retiree demand and pitching that, because that, I think, even if you look at Sydney in terms of some of the infill projects, is where you're starting to see demand come through for well-positioned, you know, part of existing communities, and there is definitely a market still there.
All right. Well, let's talk about the ACT. Good old Canberra. Is it following in the footsteps of Sydney, or what's happening there?
No, Canberra's not following in the footsteps of Sydney. It's definitely beating to the march of its own drum, and it's a situation where the local economy has done extremely well, probably better than any other. Maybe Victoria would be close over the last 5 years, and for similar reasons. It's both have had residential building booms, inner-city apartment booms in terms of construction, and as a result, the economic environment, the wider economic environment's been very sound. Still got strong population growth. The problem, I think, for the next couple of years is that is twofold. One is that the apartment supply pipeline is starting to dwindle, and so the building activity is going to be much lower in 2 years' time. We know that the commercial building pipeline there is very limited, certainly in terms of the office sector, and there's not really any major engineering projects coming through either. So when you add that to the fact that there's every prospect of, you know, either by natural attrition or outright redundancy, decreasing the public sector workforce, maybe into 2013, it's not a fantastic environment for Canberra. The caveat on all of that is that certainly while the public sector workforce is under review, the rate of people who are reaching retirement age and will retire because they're fully superannuated is actually very substantial. And what that means is that there's more overseas migrants in particular coming into Canberra to fill roles at a much higher rate than what we've seen, you know, in the past, and certainly in the last 10, 20 years. And so even if there is a desire to reduce the workforce through natural attrition, I think only within the space of a couple of years that could happen through retirements, and then we're back in the need for still high population growth in order to offset the retirement phase. So that means that I think the overall economy will actually weather the decline in, or the, you know, at least a cap on public sector employment. I think it is not a medium term issue. The bigger problem is probably the apartment building pipeline, because we know that the private sector has been doing very well in Canberra. So there is an opportunity now to maybe get some public works projects going. There's discussion about works between Civic and the Lake, and I think that would be ideally timed, and the government would get good value for its money.
Okay, so it's kind of trucking on in there. Again, manufacture growth, if you're going to do anything in Canberra, at least for a couple of years, but we'll see what happens after that. Now let's talk about Melbourne. Melbourne's been the golden child for about the last 5 years, so where do we sit now?
All good things must come to an end, and and they are. So for Melbourne, it's been record conditions, depending on what year you look at. So if you go back to 2009, record annual growth in house prices. If you look at 2011, record rates of residential construction. And it starts getting up to an over 60,000 for the total state, and record levels within Melbourne as well. So this has been a virtuous cycle of strong residential building, drawing in more population growth, leading to more demand for housing, leading to more population growth, and then rippling out in terms of commercial sector, retail sales, so on and so forth. So it shows you the power, if a state government can set up the residential planning process right, the power that can come with that. Like the obvious issue is that actually I think some of that capitalisation into land values has overshot, that the price of lots is not as competitive as it was, and that's one factor. Probably the more important one is that the government has, up until the current administration, put a lot of focus on incentivising first home buyers, in particular buying new dwellings, particularly in regional areas, but also in Melbourne. And they've kept them on the drip, but now that is being cut off. So the concessions for first home buyers are being wound back substantially from this point on. And I think what that means is that we get a quite a deep and fairly rapid slowing in terms of the residential building sector. Actually, one is well underway as we speak in terms of detached houses in the fringe and in regional areas, and I think the ending of those concessions is merely going to exacerbate that and deepen it. At the same time, we had part of that record year last year was an absolute boom in terms of inner-city apartment construction, easily record levels, more than twice the previous historical highs, and as a result, I think we're going to have an oversupply in terms of inner-city apartments. I think we're going to get an inner-city apartment vacancy rate that's going to push up over 5%. That's the kind of world where you get outright declines in terms of rentals. That's where you start to get real pain for investors. And a lot of these projects are going to settle at a similar point in time into 2013. And I'm concerned about, you know, settlement risk for some of those projects. Even if that doesn't transpire, the bottom line is that you've got a simultaneous downturn in terms of residential building, commercial building, declining in engineering construction, public sector cutbacks by the state government. It's really looking like a perfect storm, unfortunately, for Melbourne. And we may well look back in 10 years' time and say, look, it was, you know, the end of a golden run, and, you know, you smooth it out over that period, probably Victoria still comes ahead because of its better planning environment, because of a pretty sound way of managing the process.
And lower cost construction.
Yeah, for some areas. But that doesn't mean that you can't, that you still don't get a cycle. If anything, what it means is that the cycle can run more powerfully, and that's what we're seeing. And so I think as a result, 2013 is going to be a foundation year in terms of people's view on the national economy, that we're going to have such a substantial downturn in Victoria that we're going to need more rate cuts, that the upturns in Queensland and Western Australia still won't be enough. And that we will have a lot more angst about, well, we're bringing in workers to work in, you know, central Queensland, northern Queensland, in Western Australia, but we've got this rising unemployment rate in Victoria, you know, what should we do about it? Well, I think what happens is a lot of people will move of their own accord. And so the next phase of this cycle is that we'll have a return to big outflows of people, of families from Victoria to Queensland, to Western Australia, and that will accentuate and accelerate residential market upturns in Perth and Brisbane, as well as in some regional centres. But this is the glass half full to Victoria's glass half empty.
Yeah. So we've got really moving markets right around Australia. I mean, some are on the upswing, some are not. They're on the levelling out and often downswing. We've got a lot of regional centres, which obviously we don't have time to go through today, but there is huge opportunities in some of those regional centres from a growth perspective and yield. You know, the yield right across Australia has been strong, and, you know, we kind of touched on that a little bit, but in some of the regional centres, mainly driven by the resource sector, the yields are absolutely fabulous. I've actually got I don't know whether you know it, Jason, but I've got a Boomtown series coming out shortly where I actually talk about, you know, the dynamics and what's happening around Australia from more of a regional perspective. And, you know, it's certainly something that you need to be educated. It's not for the uneducated, I'm just going to buy something and it'll happen for me. You need to be educated. You need to be making your selections based on the strategy that suits your portfolio and your risk management, whether that be income replacement or whether it be growth in your properties. You know, there's certainly huge opportunities right around Australia for both. But I think, you know, speaking to you today, there's one message that the investors can get is that you have to choose your market according to your requirement. Just investing in your next suburb probably isn't going to cut it for you. It's certainly not going to meet all your needs, but there are all of your needs met if you go to where they're going to be met. Would you agree with me on that one?
Definitely. And, you know, we're not in a world where we're in for a long extended downturn in residential property prices. That is not going to happen.
Can I just talk to you about that, just to stop you there for a minute? Mm. Because there was an American gentleman who made a big splash in the newspapers about a year ago now, last October it was, coming out here saying that we're in for a massive, massive reduction like what happened in America, da-da-da. And, all, I mean, I looked at his arguments at the time. I thought it was a load of crap. But anyway, I'll leave it up to you as to what you thought. His name's obviously Harry Dent. What's your take on that?
No, I think the foundation of that analysis is not right. There seems to be a contention that rentals in Australia are nowhere near sufficient to explain the price growth that we've had. Well, that's just not true. If you look at a market like Sydney, over the last 10 years to 2011, the price growth in compound terms citywide has been comparable to the rate of rent growth. Now, in other cities, the price growth has been somewhat higher, but we're talking in the order of 10 or 15%. So over 10 years. So we only need a couple of years of strong rental growth, and that equation is pretty much even Stevens.
Which is what we're experiencing in the ones that are due to go up.
Indeed. And so I think on the score of rentals, we've just got the census data out. The census data in terms of the rental values and the distribution of rental increases is by far and away the superior measure of what market conditions are, and it's plain as the back of your hand. Sydney, for example, had rental growth of 40% over the 5 years to 2011. Other cities have had more, other cities have had marginally less. But this contention that somehow we like the US just doesn't hold water, because you've got huge support for prices that have come through from rentals. Now, it may well be that in terms of the upper end of the market, that equation is not as compelling. I can certainly see a world where there's sustained underperformance from premium end, you know, upper quartile property values across eastern cities for the next 5 to 10 years. But in terms of you want to mount an argument about overall prices, the rentals just will not allow that kind of price decline to happen. So that would be my primary response is...
Also, America's oversupplied, or was, leading into the GFC and all that sort of stuff. We are not.
No, we're not. And the rental... And there's been, you know, ongoing tit-for-tat battles about, well, what is oversupply? And, you know, we've got all this vacant stock of housing. This last census told us we had this many vacant houses. Okay, I'm sure it did. The most current census has told us that the rental growth in compound terms across each capital city has been in the order of 5% to 7%. Now, that is the only number that is important, because that is what people are facing at the margin. That is what they're having to pay. We have a huge housing supply problem, and that is the evidence of it. Any other kind of data points are by the by. And so what you then need to do is follow through on the logic of that argument and say, okay, where can I find the best rental growth? Because this is not about a leveraging process anymore going forward. We're not about 7 or 8% citywide price growth. Choose your cities wisely, then focus on built form, because you can extract more value from having smaller scale lots, from having smaller floor areas, than you can from buying an established property. So there is an advantage for the developers in this world, because they can better meet the market by choosing the right product type. But then small-scale players can do that too.
That's
so
exactly right.
There's opportunities, but it's more from that angle than what it is from, well, I'm just going to buy a unit, and as long as it's near a train station, then I should expect to do X, Y, and Z. Well, that's not correct. So you need to do a rethink in terms of strategies, but the strategies need to acknowledge the affordability issues that exist, but those affordability issues are where the opportunities are. They define the opportunities. They're not the threat. They're the opportunity.
Mm. Well, Jason, you've been fabulous as usual, and passing on all of that that wisdom to all of my listeners. As we've said, there are opportunities there at both ends of the scale, depending on whether you want cash flow, you want growth, you want natural growth, you want manufactured growth. They're right across Australia, but you do have to be, you have to pick your mark. You have to pick the style and the type and the area for the property that suits your portfolio and what you need next in that growth process. So you are an absolute wonder. You've been instrumental for a lot of my students' successes when I get you in to come and have a chat to them and things like that. So thanks once again. And, good luck for a huge year ahead, huh?
That's a pleasure. Thank you very much. And... you know, I think the messages that I've talked through, hopefully in a year's time we can look back and say, yep, we're on track.
You don't go quite as far as saying I told you so, huh?
No, there's no point in being too pointed.
I tell you what, I have tracked you for a number of years, and when I look back at the statements you've made and the predictions you've made, you know, over a lot of years, you have plenty of opportunities to say, I told you so.
Yeah, well, you know, you don't stay in business, I think, in this environment very long if you're not adding value to your clients.
Yeah. Well, from one economist to another, thank you so much and thank you for sharing.
That's a pleasure. Thanks for the opportunity.
Okay, guys. Well, bye for now. We'll catch you again next week with another exciting episode on something completely different. Talk to you again soon. Bye.